Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Meta. I am your host, Jay Larson, and this episode we have a very special guest joining us, one Pat Dunford. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, Jay, and hey, listeners. How's it going?
I'm doing quite well. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Aside from the heat, things in London are pretty good right now.
I just actually got back from a visit to Boston, and we wanted to do a fair bit of walking, etc., but there were some heat wave warnings going on, and so we didn't get as much done outside as we would have liked to, but it was still a really good time.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. Boston is not known for being a hot place, right?
I think it's one of those places that are blessed that their winters are awful and their summers can be awful too. And so,
oh great, the worst of
yeah.
The world.
It kind of raises the question of why anyone lives there, but I guess it is what it is.
Perfect.
Okay, so this first episode, we actually, just to go over again the format of The Meta, we try to have on a guest host who is authoritative and knowledgeable about the faction that we're going to talk about. And we're doing a part A that is free that anyone can listen to. And with part B, anyone who does a $1 backer level on Patreon, you can listen to part B. But also there's a $2 level on Patreon that you can do that. If you sign up at that, then you get to be in a Discord channel for The Meta with me, and you'll get to ask questions that make suggestions on who to have on and also ask questions that we'll relay on to the host. So starting off, we're actually going to start with some questions that people sent in for you, Patrick.
Oh, very cool.
So starting off, we have Dr. Glenn. He says, do you see yourself looking at Crucible Guard again in the future, or are you going to just stick with Grimkin for now?
That is a really good question. And with the big shakeup to the meta coming along with Oblivion, I've definitely been considering the same thing myself. I don't think I've made up my mind quite yet, but every faction is looking really, really appealing right now, you know?
Yep.
There's loads of cool new options and theme forces. Slight points tweaks make old models more appealing. Then you've got the new theme forces and this kind of weird cross-faction thing going on, where a lot of the factions can take lists that use models from other factions, especially on the War Machine side, less so in Hordes. But I've been looking at Grimkin, and for sure they change a lot and they improve a lot with the opening up of their theme forces. Crucible Guard, I think, do the same. And a lot of the Crucible Guard lists I want to build weren't possible in the old themes, but are possible in the new. Mm. So that's really exciting.
Have they teased any of the Crucible Guard themes yet?
No, so that's a great point. This is with a caveat, but I'm assuming no changes other than removing the old point restrictions that meant one theme had to be mostly jacks and one theme had to be mostly infantry. I'm just assuming that's the only change. If there's more changes, then what I say might not be true. Or on the other hand, it might open things up even further. But with that modest change, I think it changes list building quite a lot for Crucible.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that I actually played a fair bit of Sylvestro in both themes, and I did enjoy playing him in a jack-heavy list, jack-heavy environment. But if you're able to kind of meld him where he's trying to get the best of both worlds, then him in particular, that seems quite exciting.
Yeah, I really agree. I think when I think about the lists I ran with Sylvestro in Prima Materia, I had the luxury of having all of the huge bases I wanted plus Tauros. And Tauros with +2 speed from Super Fuel and with Admonition are just incredible.
Right, yep.
But in that theme, he lacked the infantry that he supports really well.
Right.
And in Magnum Opus, I loved having Rocket Men and Steelhead Halberdiers with Transmutation and bringing them back with Revive.
Yep.
But then I couldn't have both the Vulcan and Tauros.
Right.
Whereas now you can do assuming that the changes are, as we said, you can do a best of both worlds where you have those high defense infantry and you have all the warjacks you want to maximize his synergy.
Right.
So I think that's really cool. And I think the same applies for a lot of the other casters. For example, Gearheart is a great example where Gearheart is incredible with the Vulcan, but also incredible with Crucible Guard infantry. And the Crucible Guard infantry really wants retaliators with their sprays. And you can't fit it all in the same theme force and maximize 3 points. Except, presumably, now you will be able to. So I think Crucible Guard, more than most factions, will see some immediate changes to their list composition, assuming their theme forces pan out anything like the norm that we've seen spoiled so far.
So do you expect that we're going to see most of the casters gravitate now to Magnum Opus with maybe like Locke or something as maybe a Prima Materia holdout?
Yeah, I think so. I think they would need to do something pretty special to Prima Materia to make it more compelling than Magnum Opus. Bear in mind, Magnum Opus has literally no model restrictions on the faction.
Right.
It lets you take every single model in the faction plus mercenaries. Whereas Prima Materia doesn't. And the competing theme benefits, and once again, this is assuming no changes, but the competing theme benefits, Magnum Opus gives you plus one to the roll to go first, so presumably that would change to a reroll.
Right.
Which is very valuable. And it gives you reposition 3 on your artillery and solos, which I found to be fantastic in Crucible Guard, mm-hmm. because Trancers, Hutchuck, and Gorman with reposition are all incredible.
Especially since we know from one of the spoils that Hungerford gave that both lists are going to have 3 transfers as a requisition point. Or maybe it's 2 transfers.
Yeah, probably 2, because they're 3 points a model.
Yeah, 2.
Yeah.
But both of them are going to have that. So
yeah, because then you get to have more free points than you did before as well. Because in my Magnum Opus list, I almost always took 4 trances.
Right.
So taking them for free is going to give me more points than I otherwise would have saved in the old builds, even by maximizing free points. So that's all really, really exciting. And I think those lists are going to be incredible. But as you said, I think it will be pretty rare to see someone staying in Prima Materia. Because really, what does it offer? It offers a theme benefit of Vanguard shield guarding twice. It offers plus 2-inch deployment, but every other theme we've seen so far has lost that for no benefit.
Yep.
So we might assume the same.
Yep.
And the other thing is it gives you more different requisition options.
Right.
It technically gives you more points because one of the things on its list is the Alchemist unit, which is 7 points. So you might be able to make a very corner case list that has both Vanguards and wants to use Alchemists.
Right.
And at that point, it might be more appealing to you. But I think that's going to be pretty rare. And I think even a caster like Locke is going to say, well, actually, Vanguards are fine, but I'd rather have access to every model in the faction.
Yeah, that makes sense. It'll be interesting to see if the way that they deal with this is potentially restricting down Magnum Opus some. It'd be a little bit sad for Crucible Guard players if they did that, maybe, but it might be one way that they try to diversify it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. I mean, the other option would be they combine the theme forces, but that seems unlikely in a faction that only has 2.
Right.
I mean, for a start, champions wouldn't work properly in that point, would they? They'd have to make a whole new rule for that. So that doesn't seem very likely. A third option might be to change up Prima Materia and make it more compelling in another way.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe you further restrict it, but you give it more benefits or something. I'm not sure.
Right.
But that would be pretty unlikely as well. So I don't really know. It's going to be really interesting over the next few days to see how things settle for Crucible Guard themes, because I think that will dictate a lot about how lists look and which casters rise in popularity.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting. It feels like we're currently around 85-90% of the way there to knowing all the Oblivion stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be very interesting to see what that last, finally see the full picture. Because there's a few things where on the holdouts, you're like, this could actually be pretty impactful on whichever way it ends up going. So
for sure. Is there anything in particular you're thinking about when you say that?
I mean, the way that the Crucible Guard ones line out is obviously something we're just covering. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of which. I'm kind of lumping this in with it, I guess, but I'm curious to see if there are any other in the rules digest in Oblivion, if there are any other rules updates that haven't really been kind of previewed yet that we're going to still see. I'm guessing there's not going to be anything big, but it's still kind of on my mind.
Oh, yeah, that could be interesting. The other thing that obviously is happening at the same time is the developer update.
Yeah, the dynamic update. Rules, yeah.
The dynamic update, yeah, with points changes and rebalancing.
Yeah.
Potentially buffs and anti-buffs. And how big those changes are will be very impactful as well, of course. They've talked about a couple of nerfs, a couple of buffs, a couple of point changes, but it's not clear to me from the way they've done it if they are being sparing with the spoilers on that, or if there just aren't that many changes.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something that I'm intrigued with as well. It also, it seems like, you know, they've previewed several decreases in power with Circle, mm-hmm. but I'm curious, and it also seems like, which I appreciate, it seems like they are trying to not drop the, you know, the hammer and make it so that stuff is not interesting to play anymore. But for example, the Tharn Ravagers, there's been discussion or rumors about them being looked at for quite a while, and it is going to be interesting to see if they get any type of examination, and if they do, then what type of adjustment they get. So
yeah, for sure. And the reason I bring this up is, as in addition to Crucible Guard and Grimkin, I've also been looking again at my Signar.
Oh yeah,
Signar,
yeah.
Of course, being a faction that I played for a very long time,
correct,
all of
yeah.
Mark II, and for the first year or so of Mark III. And they also have a bunch of stuff coming out in Oblivion with the Morrow theme force that can be played in Signar.
Right.
And one of the things that I think Signar suffers from is it's still got quite a big stable of models that are just looking a bit too expensive.
Right.
And it would be interesting to see if they're the kind of thing that get touched by points adjustments. You know, they talked about the Hurricane and the Stormwall getting cheaper.
Right.
Does that mean they looked at every Warjack, or right. is it just the Hurricane and the Stormwall?
I'm guessing it's I'm guessing it's likely just going to be the huge bases, but it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, for sure.
This isn't a listener question, but I am pretty interested in your take on this. The Signar Facebook groups are pretty downtrodden, pretty sad right now. Do you think that, I guess, that's justified or valid, or is it really as bad as they think it is?
I don't think it's as bad as they think it is. I think people are especially low point in the preview cycle right now, where they feel like they've not been shown anything good for their faction and other factions have.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there was a furore about the Lely's theme force right. versus the Sons of the Tempest theme, and how Lely's has got better gun mages than Sons of the Tempest, arguably. I'm not sure I agree, but either way, I think it's weird to me. I don't understand. It wasn't that long ago that I was speaking on Tactical Tips, the podcast that I used to do, and I was talking about how Signar was number one in the meta.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long ago that Haley 3 plus Nemo 3 was the terror of tournaments, right?
Right.
Scourge of the top tables. And there was a concerted effort in CID campaigns to... people were always asking the question, how can we survive Nemo 3? What
right.
about this faction can handle Nemo 3, you know?
Right.
And yeah, Nemo 3 got a little bit of a nerf. And certainly Signar has had a lot of nerfs this edition, which in hindsight maybe didn't deserve all of those. But the faction still has lots of really strong tools. And... in the current meta, some of the things in it that are really good, like, for example, Haley 3 Gravediggers, are still really good. And I don't fully understand why so many people have moved away from it competitively. I guess my answer is, I do think that faction is strong. It's looking... the changes in Oblivion are looking really positive for it, and I think it's
right.
got great potential.
Right.
And I've had a lot of fun making some very different, unorthodox lists with Signar that you wouldn't expect to see with the new themes. And things out of CID, like Constance Blaze, like the new theme forces, and the ability to play combined arms again with Signar, I think it's got a lot of potential.
So I have a bit of a hypothesis with Signar, and I'm curious if... I'm going to float it past you and see if you agree or disagree with it. But it somewhat relates specifically to Haley 3, which you brought up. I do think that she's still quite strong in just period. and I think that one of the things that happened is that you had players like Jake Wilstrop, who were doing very well with her.
Mm-hmm.
And he was grinding out a ton of games with that caster and doing very well with her. And I think that he eventually got to a point, and players like him, a lot of Signar players like him, kind of got to a point where they were just burned out on Haley 3, and that they felt like they kind of needed, in order to be competitive with Signar, they needed to be playing a lot of Haley 3, and they were ready to move on and play something different. And that there weren't as many new players who were picking her up, or she is a caster who you're going to need to be a pretty good player to have her do well, and you're going to have to get in a lot of reps with her, a lot of, you know, to get her performing well and performing well in an appropriate amount of time. And she's also kind of a very mentally taxing caster sometimes, where it can go to very long games at an event where, you know, some players are done after an hour of play and almost all of your games are taking almost 2 hours. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Do you think that those are some of the things that have been going on with Signar?
Yeah, I think it can definitely have an impact, for sure. I know that was the case with Jake. It was definitely part of the reason that I stopped playing Signar when I did. I mean, that was mainly just my excitement for Grimkin being
sure,
honest.
Yeah.
But I played a lot of Haley 3 when she first came out, and for the entirety of Mark 2 from her release until the end of that edition. And I definitely agree that the burnout is real when you're playing a caster that's that intensive.
Right.
It's a big factor. And sometimes, yeah, the grass is greener, or you just want to try something different, and you can have wins that are frankly easier.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in my play experience, you know, there's some casters that I've played a lot of reps with. Like in Mark 2, I played a lot of Haley 2. I played a lot of Horluck 1. And you can definitely get to the point where you're just like, you know, any caster. But even though they could still be great lists, whatever, it's just like, it's time for something new.
Yeah, you definitely can. And I think it's interesting because I think War Machine community is not huge. And it tends to be that the people who are very good at the game do well with whatever faction they're playing at the time. And those two things combined means it doesn't take much for one or two people to move off a faction.
Right.
And for people to think they're not competitive anymore because right. they're not running events. And I don't think it's always that simple.
Right. I would also like, there were also another example of something that I think might be going on as well, is that you mentioned that there have been sort of a string of nerfs that happened to Signar. And mm-hmm. one of the things that that I experienced when I was playing Haley 2 was she would go through a series of nerfs, and at the time I would recognize A, Haley 2 is still very strong, and B, these nerfs were needed, but also C, it was kind of like, you know what, I just don't want to spend the time remastering this caster with its new rule set or whatever. And there's sometimes when a nerf happens where you get like a sour taste in your mouth where you're like, yes, I understand this is needed, but I just want to play something different now.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if it's just a psychological thing.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it.
But yeah, it always feels worse playing with something that used to be more powerful, right?
Yeah.
And it's really hard not to compare it. And I've been able to, I battled through Haley nerfs for a long time, but after the most recent nerf, I don't think I've played with Haley since then.
Right. Right.
I think it's partly because whether it's good for the game or not, even if the model's too powerful, part of the fun you have with it is doing whatever it does, right? And you create right. a connection then to that stuff with the right. fun you're having. And if you can't do that stuff anymore, it just stops being as fun, and you just pick it up and you're like, oh, I remember when this model used to do cool stuff.
Right. And I think that one of the things that you've seen happen is that in a lot of ways what the War Machine meta or the War Machine community in general defines as the health or success of a faction overall is kind of the results of a small percentage of players who are going regularly to conventions and who's winning at a convention and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is kind of like you said, where it's easy for, if that small percentage of players, if they get tired of a faction and they move on to something else, it is kind of difficult right now. Like if you were, let's say you're a player who performs well at big events, and you decide, you know, I want to start playing a new faction, or I'm going to switch it up now. It feels like there hasn't been much reason or much draw for players to be like, okay, I'm going to pick Signar as my faction, even though there isn't necessarily a reason why they couldn't or shouldn't. It just has, it hasn't been drawing in top level players. And one thing that's nice is that I do think that the changes with the theme remix and also all of the new items that with the new theme, the Partisan Morrow and stuff, etc. I think that there is a chance that you are now going to see some of those top players who are like, oh, this would be interesting to give Signar a try. And so even though potentially not much could be changing beyond what the changes that everyone's going to see with theme forces opening up, etc. I am kind of expecting to see things changing some with the results for Signar.
Oh, they're going to change a lot for sure. I know that I'm looking at Signar right now, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. That faction is so big.
Right.
There's so much depth in models. Like, as soon as you have a big shakeup like this, suddenly everything in its bag is back on the table, you know, and there's a lot of stuff that you can go through, and there's a lot of potential. Not to mention that one of the things that I think will dictate how this pans out in the, not the short term, because I think short term is going to be very chaotic for list building, and there'll be all kinds of crazy things. But in the medium term, a new meta is going to form, right?
Right,
and
yeah.
Some things are going to be seen to be very powerful, and then answers are going to form to those things. And so it's not just about what is on its face the most powerful in these changes, but also you've got to try and think a step ahead and think, okay, right. If theme X, Y, and Z are looking really, really good, what are the natural answers to those, and how might I want to build a pair to deal with them?
Right. So real quick before we move on from this question, we do know from the teasers that we've received that the Stormwall and the Hurricane are going down in point cost. Do you think that they are going to be at a point cost where they're going to be attractive now?
Yeah, I think so. I was somebody that happily paid 39 points for Hurricane, and I consider it to be the best Jack in the faction, and it getting a points reduction makes it even more compelling. It has such incredible synergy with so many casters in Signar. It's such a powerful piece for turn-on-turn damage output, plus ball control, plus assassination potential. My favorite casters in Signar, I will start with a Hurricane before I've considered what theme force they're going to be in. And now, with the changes to theme forces, that makes those casters much more viable.
Is it going from 39 to 35, is that right?
Yes, so yeah. 4-point reduction.
Yeah, that's big. Obviously.
Yeah. Some of my favorite casters with the Hurricane, Striker 1, Kane 1, Kane 3, Kara Sloan, Haley 1, Haley 2. They all do such incredible things for that Colossal. And now you can take it, you can have them synergize with it, and then you can build a list that's doing something else and working with their other synergies. Whereas previously, you basically had to play it in heavy metal.
Right. One of the things that's a little bit sad for me is that probably out of all my models in War Machine and Hordes, probably my favorite model as far as like paint job and everything that I have with it is my Stormwall. Mm-hmm. I think it's just an amazing looking model that Ashton painted for me. And one of the sad things is that, you know, it's great that it's going down in points, but it does kind of feel like anytime you start looking at the list building, you're kind of presented with the problem of, okay, why would I pay one more point for a Stormwall that probably isn't as good as the Hurricane anyway at 1 point less?
Yeah, I do think that's slightly strange. My personal opinion, I heavily favor the Hurricane over the Stormwall, but I know that not everyone feels the same way, and the Stormwall obviously has things going for it. The way that it matches up best in comparison is it's much better at dealing with light infantry, right? It's got electroleaps on its fists, it's got the covering fire templates, and it's got the Storm Pods. The Storm Pods also give you an extra option for contesting, which may be more relevant than ever in these very wide scenarios. And I think you'll see Stormwalls be more attractive if the meta shifts in such a way where people are using a lot of light infantry and those particular tools are at a premium.
It kind of feels like people hated playing against Storm Pods so much in Mark II that the designers are overvaluing that feature a little much in the current edition.
Yeah, I agree. It is a very unusual effect, though, and it is hard to value fairly.
Yep.
It's the kind of thing that can be useless in some matchups and can just kill 6 to 10 points a turn for free in others. So.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for that question, Dr. Glenn. We spend about a half hour talking about it.
We got a lot of mileage out of that one.
That's yeah. So next question is from NACI3PO. He says, what advice can you give for people when they inevitably come up against Clockatress spam?
Oh my gosh. Now I'm trying to figure that out for myself. In the drinking mirror, the answer seems to be just have more Clockatresses than your opponent.
Okay.
So that's not really great advice for everyone else.
If somehow possible, assassinate their caster first.
Yeah, assassinating is definitely good. Cockatrices are really powerful, and they don't have that many really obvious or great counters. They do have some. They don't have very many, like, silver bullets, right? They don't have things that completely shut them out of the game. But things that I've found that are pretty good against them, in no particular order, Grievous Runes is really good against them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, their teleport works, their time stutter works when they get crippled. So if you can Grievous Runes them, they'll get away, but then they won't do very much. And then that can leave you in a pretty advantaged position where you can deal with them in subsequent turns. Grievous Runes already is very good against Grimkin because it helps deal with Sacrifice Arcana. So that's really useful. Precision Strike is not a very common rule, but it's really, really good against Clockatrices. And similar rules like Deadly Shot are really, really good. There's a couple of places where there's a lot of Precision Strike, a couple that spring to mind. You've got the Kador Theme Force that runs all the Iron Fangs.
Mm.
And that is devastating for Clockatrices because although they've got a good spray, they can't really spray them all. And if they get too close, then they get charged. They get countercharged by precision striking guys. So that's very, very difficult for them.
So before we go on, let's dig in a little bit deeper just so that players understand the strategy that you're employing with the precision strike. I'm assuming that you are seeing the damage roll and then trying to pick a column where you're not going to break an aspect and then spread out the damage. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So precision strike lets you pick the column. Clockatrices have 9 damage points in mind, 9 in body, and 9 in spirit. And it should be fairly simple with almost all expected rolls for something like an Iron Fang Pipeman to be able to put your damage in a series of places so that you're not crippling the Clockatrice and you can get more hits in and they will get fewer time stutters. It might be that you still get unlucky and trigger a time stutter, but that's likely to be when they're almost dead already, and it should be easier to finish them off. And in most cases, you can expect to kill them without them ever stuttering.
Right. You'll spread out the damage and then get one final killing blow.
Yeah, exactly. Another list that has a lot of precision strike is Locke in Crucible Guard and Convergence. She gives her whole battle group precision strike, and that's very good against Clockatrices as well.
Okay.
Aside from those like specific rules-related answers, there's a couple of things that just in general are good. If you have a lot of troops or just disposable bodies, surrounding them to block their time stutter can be effective. You have to be really careful though, because it's hard to block a 3-inch place.
Right. Yeah.
I've seen people kind of do it lazily without checking and discover that actually there's a lot of room for Clockatrices to go between bases and that kind of thing. So you need to have quite a lot of models and you have to be careful with how you do it. You also have to watch out for surrounding them in such a way where they time stutter once to move to a slightly better position, and then the second time stutter gets them out of danger, even when surrounded. But it is possible if you're running a list with a lot of melee infantry, then that's a good tactic. If you're not running a lot of melee infantry, then another good option, honestly, is just shooting, right? Time stutter is way worse against guns, and that is something to keep in mind. In the meta right now, we don't see a lot of gun lines. And the guns that we do see are very often on battle engines that have firing arcs or colossals. And those are quite weak to Clockatrices because time stutter will let you move out of an arc. So you shoot me with your first gun, you cripple me, and then I move out of the arc of the second. And that works very well against things like tridents, galleons, or whatever it might be. But against just traditional boosted guns from things like heavies, it's very easy to finish off Clockatrices that have time stutters away. And I think Clockatrices are doing quite well in the meta right now because the things that they prey upon are very prevalent and the things that are good against them are less popular, like the guns that I mentioned.
So one follow-up question about the Clockatrices.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been probably a month or two ago at this point, but there was someone who, there was a discussion about the Clockatrices that got started on the War Machine General page. And two of the points that several people were saying in general, one was that they thought that the Clockatrice was probably now the best war beast in the game. And the follow-up point was that they thought that it was probably a little bit too good in its current incarnation. I'm curious what your opinion is on those two points.
Yeah, I think it probably is the best in the game. I mean, that's a slightly dubious title because, I mean, things have specializations, right?
Right.
So it's a little bit of rhetoric to say it's the best in the game. It's the best at some things. It's probably the best value for its points.
Mm.
It's probably where it's the best, right? as opposed to any other category. And that's an important thing to be good at, for sure, in a game about points. Being the best value for your points is real strong. I kind of agree that it's probably a little too good, and the reason I think it's a little too good is because I find myself just keep wanting to add more and more to my lists.
Right.
And questioning why I'm including any other beasts. And all of the other Grimkin beasts are really great. So when I'm at that point, that tells me, yeah, maybe it is a bit too strong. So yeah, I kind of have to agree with that a little bit. After that, I think it's just... I mean, it's hard to say, is it too good? Yeah, it's the best. It's probably too strong in the faction. Therefore, it probably is a bit too good. Is it as egregious as the other things that are too good that need to be nerfed? Maybe. I wouldn't be surprised if the Clock of Trees got changed. I think it wouldn't need a lot to be brought back in line. A slight points change, for example, or maybe one or two tweaks to its stat line. I don't think it is broken in a way that is warping the meta too much, but we'll have to see how things go. It's hard to say on the cusp of Oblivion because there's so much change happening.
Right.
I think we'll know for sure if the dust settles, everyone's tried their new stuff, and then lists with six Clock of Trees are just dominating everyone still.
Yeah.
Then we'd know, okay, yeah, this is a huge problem.
Well, I guess a couple points on that. I don't think that there's going to be anything about the Clock of Trees in the dynamic update, and part of what I'm basing that on is so Jeff Olson, one of the developers for Privateer Press, he participates pretty regularly in the Grimkin group, and he plays the King of Nothing quite a bit. That's his main caster, and there have been several people who have been like, you know, I'm thinking about buying some Clockatrices, but I'm a little bit concerned about taking the plunge if they're going to actually get nerfed. And Jeff's response has always been like, what are you talking about? No, there's not going to be anything going on with the Clockatrice. And so I think that we're kind of in the stage where Privateer Press wants more data before deciding if they're going to do something with that model. So
I think it's interesting because I think they're in a slightly awkward spot, partly by virtue of it being a limited faction, but with the scenarios becoming more spread out, which really hurts brick lists.
Right.
And with the changes to bump through CID being fine, but nothing to really write home about, it feels like in a lot of ways the Clockatrice is really propping up the competitive viability of Grimkin right now. And it's doing a lot to make the list fast, to make them flexible, to give them game into hard-hitting models like Tharn, which without them, I think you look at your everything in your faction, you'd be like, oh, I can't beat these models.
Right.
You know? So... I think the Clockatrice is in a slightly awkward spot where if it does get nerfed, then it might just take the faction with it and hit it a bit too hard competitively.
True.
So I think they've got to be careful about that and consider what options they have. And I think they're right to think really hard whether or not it's necessary.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm curious. Excuse me. You mentioned briefly the new scenarios and them being difficult on brick lists. I've done a little bit of playing Grimkin in the new scenarios with as I've been waiting for my Infernals to get painted and ready to play on the table. But I'm curious what your experiences have been playing Grimkin in the new scenarios. Part of my experience has been that I've had a fair number of matchups where people can potentially deal with the Gremlin Swarms, but a Gremlin Swarm that is on the extreme edge of the table is another matter altogether in a lot of cases, and ends up kind of saving my bacon in certain matchups. But I'm curious what your experiences have been like.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Jay. I found exactly the same thing. Because those zones are just so far to the sides of the table, people don't have a lot of models with magic weapons that play that far away. And in the past, the way that they got around that was with their objective that granted magic weapons. But when the gremlins are right on the side of the table, often the model that wants to receive that magic weapon just isn't in range of the gremlin.
Right.
So I found that's been really helpful. And it's definitely given them some game in contesting. I don't think it's flawless by any means. And I think a lot of good lists still have ways to deal with them.
Right.
In particular, there's actually quite a lot of units that have ambush and magic weapons.
Right.
Tharn Blood Reavers, mm-hmm. Satixis, Night Witches, Grimkin Murder Crows, all of this stuff has magic weapons and ambushes.
I think you're just about to start seeing the min unit of cultists with the three weapon attachments for a requisition point become a popular ambushing option as well.
Right, and do they all have magic weapons?
It's just
they've got their magic ability.
I know that the three weapon attachments have magic weapons, mm-hmm. which have gang and are hitting well and hard. So, but let me look real quick on the normal ones.
Well, even if it's just three, right? That is that's plenty to kill a gremlin swarm. Yep. They've got reach. They're not going to suffer annoyance.
Yep.
They're very high mat. It's almost a sure thing at that point.
Right. I think you're needing a five at that point to hit roll, and so that's likely going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting to consider if you're really worried about Grimkin and you want to win on scenario, then the value of those units in ambush definitely goes up. I think although the gremlins are a little harder to kill, I think that's more than offset by the fact it's much harder to contest all of the relevant pieces with your heavies while staying in range of your death knell. And that was the classic Grimkin maneuver, was just create a brick in the center of the table. By brick, I mean have very hard to kill models, just sit there, take the charge, and then retaliate. And it's more and more difficult to do that and be relevant on scenario now. For myself, that's one of the reasons why I'm looking at more cockatrices.
Right.
Just because actually, through no fault of their own, models like Cage Ragers have become worse.
Right. Right.
So it is a more complicated formula, if you like, than just cockatrices are too good.
Right.
But actually, cockatrices are incredible at operating far away from the death knell. They don't need the armor for their survivability.
Right.
And they have a very long threat range with their assault sprays. They can actually affect the edges of the table while staying in your control range, which is important when you're a battle group caster. But as well as those, I've been including more Gorehounds and Rattlers and Frightmares in my list, just more lights to help with that problem. And Gorehounds in particular have been really, really fantastic for dealing with those zones.
It's also interesting in that it's felt to me, at least with some of my list building, where if I am pursuing some of those list builds like you're talking about, then suddenly I don't have to spend the points on the death knell at all.
Yes, definitely.
And then that frees up more list building options also.
Yeah, it's interesting because you kind of, in some ways, you have a couple of different builds now for Grimkin and Dark Menagerie, where the death knell is much more of a question than it was.
Right.
When I think about, do I want the death knell? I think, do I want the armor buff? And do I need the Entropic Aura? Those are the two things that I really value. And then the third thing is, do I have other models to receive the corpses that the death knell can give out? So it enhances Cage Ragers and Skin and Bones. And if I have to play so far away that I'm not going to get the aura for armor, then the death knell becomes way less appealing. But also models like Cockatrices and Gorehounds, which were never going to get that aura anyway, the way they play, starts to look better and better. And your list kind of shifts where you move away from heavies that want corpses because they're losing their support. And you take more cockatrices. And I think this goes back to what I said before, where maybe you've made me think that maybe it's not that the cockatrice is too good. Maybe it's just that to answer these scenarios, I can't afford to play a brick.
Right, yeah.
And therefore, I've only got one heavy that can actually play outside of a brick, so I take it.
Right.
It's an interesting situation for sure.
So obviously, one of the things that Steamroller does is it provides almost a kind of social engineering with the game that encourages certain types of lists, discourages other types of lists, certain models, etc. Have you liked the direction that they're going with the new Steamroller and some of the things that they're trying to do?
Yeah, I have liked it. I think the playing to the sides of the table is interesting. I think it's a little much. I think the two scenarios where the zones are touching the sides is going a bit too far. And the reason why I think that is because the game fundamentally is about warlocks and warcasters who have control areas.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to play, to enjoy a lot of what War Machine is about while also catering to those sides. And you essentially kind of just play a game of unsupported infantry versus unsupported infantry.
Right.
You know, maybe the odd battle engine thrown in. And I think it's fine for those models to be more valuable, but it's less engaging. And you don't get to enjoy a lot of the core mechanics of the game, like focus and fury management, boosting, that kind of thing. I think that might be going a little too far.
Yeah, one of the things I've noticed when I've been trying to, where those two scenarios feel so much different than the rest of the packet or what we've been used to in previous years. They're the ones that I've been trying to practice right now. And I've noticed that even, there's a lot of times where even when I am managing the scenario okay, or I'm doing okay on playing things, there's a lot of times where when I'm playing the game, it feels like just kind of stressful having this detachment that's kind of all out on its own. And it does kind of, this kind of relates to what you said. Sometimes it feels like kind of unsatisfying that you're not doing things. And sometimes I question if it's just, this is how I'm used to playing versus something new, and maybe I need to be giving something new a try. But I've had a fair number of times where I've finished the game and it just kind of felt like it wasn't as satisfying of an experience as what I'm used to. And I'm curious.
I haven't played the new scenarios as much as you, but I can definitely see where you're coming from. And I wonder if it's related to what I said in that.
Right.
It's because you just don't get to play a big part of it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there is, it feels like, and granted, I've been doing this and I have no idea if I'm even employing the proper strategy yet for approaching these scenarios. but it's felt like there's been a lot of times where my caster kind of has to pick, he's going to be supporting one of the flanks in the middle of the table, and he can't really be in the middle and supporting the whole board. And so just that feeling of like what you talked about, having almost a third of the board where you're, and it's potentially a really important part of the game that's going on there. It's very easy if one of the players is able to make the other player collapse his influence over there, then things can spiral out of control for that player pretty quickly.
Oh yeah.
And so I don't know, it's a very strange dynamic sometimes, it feels like.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the distance involved is so high on the table.
Right.
That once you've committed troops to that side, they're kind of unsupported, right? And it's like, okay, boys, good luck.
Right.
I've put out this unit and this solo. My opponent's put out the equivalent. Now let's see who wins.
Right.
And whoever wins that side is probably going to win the game on scenario.
Right.
And a lot of armies and a lot of casters right now can't do anything to swing that balance.
Right.
And makes me think that there might be a big opportunity there for different kinds of lists.
Right.
Lists with more mobility, lists with more ranged attacks, things that just generally threat further, to be much more influential in a meta where those scenarios are being played heavily.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if we see, for example, some models like, say, cavalry, you know, maybe they're initially in the center of the table, but that can swing fairly effectively to a side of the table if they're needed at some point. If that ends up becoming something that becomes more valuable or stuff like that. But it is kind of sad when, if you take, for example, Trollbloods, a faction that I've played a fair bit in the past, and I think that they could still be very viable in the new packet, the new meta, whatever. But it feels like a lot of the things that I thought about when I thought of an archetypal Trollblood list, I'm probably not going to be able to play those successfully in a third of the packet, which is a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm having the same issue with a Grimkin Brick, right?
Right.
I think.
Yeah, except trolls don't have a Clockatress.
That's true. What's their closest? Winter Troll? He's got a spray, right? Rock? He's got assault too. He's basically a Clockatress.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a lot of sympathy for the archetypal list argument, because I think if you create a meta where everyone's archetypal lists are good, then that meta doesn't change.
Sure. Or
meta does change, and then some of those people's lists are bad again. You know, it's going to come around in cycles, and at some point, your faction will be able to enjoy what you consider to be some archetypal list for it, bearing in mind that people have different expectations for what that means. But I think it's okay that whoever, like, those aren't always popular, right? And we see, for example, there were times when Kador players complained that they never got to use their heavies, and then there were other times when they used nothing but their heavies. And I'm sure the same would be true for trolls.
Yeah, and I think that it's potentially going to be in a space where, you know, you can approach a problem like this with different mindsets, and the way that you do, I think, is going to influence your success and your enjoyment. But I think it's very easy to be like, you know, I'm a troll player, I play with the Creel Stone, and I group up, etc. And if you're kind of set in that mentality, then you're going to probably not enjoy adapting or not adapt, versus to compare it to what we talked about with the Death Knell and Grimkin.
Yep.
A different way that you could be approaching it is, okay, I'm going to be trying lists that don't use the Krill Stone, and now I have all these extra points that I didn't have before, and you know, now I have a chance to think about Trollbloods in an entirely new fashion. And obviously those are very different ways of looking at things. And I think are going to have very different outcomes and levels of happiness.
Yes, exactly. You're making me think now about cool Storm of the North lists that run advanced deploying raiders plus ambushing bears and are just all over the table and really don't necessarily need a stone at all.
Right. Okay, well, this episode went a little bit longer, but that's okay. We had some good discussion. We will continue this discussion and get to more than two questions, hopefully, in part B. Everyone tune in to that. As always, the meta is sponsored by Discount Games Inc. You can email me at j@discountgamesinc.com for details on how you can get even better deals on Games Workshop and Privateer Press items. Patrick, we would definitely like to thank you for being on and having such a great discussion.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Great. And so thank you everyone for listening and hopefully we'll get to be talking with you in part B. Thank you.